We are on borrowed time, and our time together is running shorter every day. So we have to love each other, and we have to love this world passionately, intensely. You see, there is no plan B, there is no planet B. Every alternative is bad except this one. The earth is our home and always will be. And we are always guests in this home. And as guests, it might be time for us to turn the lights out, if only for a moment. And I did just that on Saturday, March 19th, when I attended the celebration of Earth Hour, an event sponsored by the Pennsylvania Interfaith Power and Light Organization. It was held at the Chestnut Hill Friends Meeting House. And I was delighted that not only was I there, but several other USG members also attended. I enjoyed sharing the space and the time with Lenny and Alan Windle and Luis Lisi and about 50 or so other attendees from our neighborhood who took part. The event started off with us looking at the SkySpace installation. I'm not sure if we've seen it here in this room. It's hard to describe, but if you could imagine looking up into the ceiling and seeing a perfect rectangle with changing colors, but that rectangle is actually the sky turning blue and green and purple and red, colors that you don't imagine the sky is having in it. Our event began by looking up at the magic of the sky and ended with us sitting for an hour in darkness. You see, Earth Hour is celebrated with darkness all around the world, and it has been since 2007. It was created by the Worldwide Fund for Nature, the WWF, as a potent symbol for our commitment to the planet. Earth Hour is designed to encourage and inspire us to make a change, to help this world. And it involves turning off non-essential lights from 8:30 to 9:30 in homes, businesses, and houses of worship. And we do that all on one night. And there's a special power that comes from sitting in a room with many people in the dark. And we felt that power as we held vigil for life on the earth as we know it. We sat in the fellowship hall in the semi-darkness. It was only lit by an array of solar-powered lamps and the orange glow of the streetlights pouring in. And the organizers of the event led us through interfaith prayers and readings. There was a local folk music band that led us in song without the aid of speakers. You see, Earth Hour was fantastic, a fantastic moment in time, and I'm very grateful to have participated. It's a particular way of bearing witness for a particular set of people. Now, I also remember looking around the room and noticing absence, noticing the absence of certain people. There were so few men in the room. There were so few people of color in the room. There were so few young people in the room. So few differently able-bodied people in the room. And yet, meanwhile, there were empty chairs. Where was everybody? The event had the unintended effect of being a delightful gathering of familiar faces, the kind that we often see in Chestnut Hill. And that is a wonderful experience. But where was everybody else? And I wondered, what kind of difference could an event like ours, as delightful as it was, what kind of difference could it make in the grand scheme of things when glaciers are melting and sea levels rising and cherry trees are in bloom just in time for New Year's? every house of worship, including the Unitarian Society of Germantown and every public space, should have thrown their doors open that night, filled to capacity with people reflecting on the state of the world and making confession for our refusal to respond to climate change in the radical ways that might actually make a difference. But it wasn't Christmas or Easter, so chairs went empty. It's hard not to be militant or condescending when you are internally discouraged and burdened by a sense of shame. Of course we could do more. Of course we should do more. Of course we have the means to do it. And it's also hard not to be undone by pride, the pride that cometh before the fall, the pride in perhaps our own individual efforts at climate justice. Both pride and shame are dangerous and lead to self-righteousness, which make friends and allies so hard to come by. You see, the challenge for us is that we need to find a purpose in the work of making the world a better place. We've spent 300 years pumping toxic chemicals into the air, water, and land. And we need something, in fact, nothing short of a theological structure with its own mythic imagery to make sense of the day-to-day efforts and frustrations that will attend the work of restoring the world to wholeness. We need an anchor. Something to hold us, and it can't be militancy, it can't be discouragement, it can't be shame or pride. The anchor that we need is to remember that this is not our world. This is a world on loan to us from the future. This spiritual understanding frees us from the path of self-interest and expediency and exploitation that have characterized a good portion of our time on this planet as human beings. This is not our world. This is a world on loan to us from the future. And this idea is captured by our Unitarian Universalist principles, all of them. And it is also a call to action, to use whatever power or privilege or influence we have to serve the higher good, by restoring the world to balance. I looked at a resource from the Union of Concerned Scientists in the United States, and they offer 10 things that we can do to restore balance. I'm going to read those 10 things to you, but don't take notes. Just listen. Number one, reduce home energy use by 10%, especially by getting away from so-called disposable products. Two, eat meat-free meals 1 day per week. Three, buy a fuel-efficient car. Four, choose an energy-efficient home and appliances. Five, stop using pesticides or the foods grown with pesticides. Six, walk, bike, or take transit to regular destinations. Seven, prepare your own meals using locally grown foods. Eight, choose a home close to regular destinations. Nine, support alternatives to the car, like trains, buses, and trolleys. And number 10, get involved, stay informed on environmental issues. Now, clearly, this is a list, and like other lists, there is the assumption of a high degree of choice. The people who create these kinds of lists tend to assume that many people can buy a new fuel-efficient car, or they can buy an energy-efficient home this close to where they work. I wish I could do many of these things. But that's beside the point. What matters is that we do the things that we can do to the best of our ability. The degree to which we are economically privileged, of course, limits or expands the kind of choices we can make. However, we have to choose to respond. We have to do the things that we do well, to do them often, and perhaps most importantly, to do them conspicuously, so that others might see and follow our good examples. We have to respond within our means, to do something with commitment, and again, to do it conspicuously so that others can see where our commitments lie. Now, I don't want to offer a scientific lecture in place of the sermon today, so I'm purposely avoiding going into the explicit details of just how far off course things have gotten for our world. And besides, I don't have to, because we all know every day we see the news items that clearly show the environmental destruction that's occurring right now and contributing to everything from the obesity epidemic to population displacement and migration to civil wars. It's becoming increasingly clear even to climate skeptics that seasonal weather patterns are out of control. The weather is more extreme and more unpredictable. And the rising seas are undeniable, especially in the low-lying places, where flooding has become a daily occurrence. But thankfully, the emphasis in the public discourse has shifted away from whether or not climate change is occurring at all to whether it's being caused by man-made factors or a natural cycle. The vast majority of experts, though, point to us as the cause for global climate change. And it's important that when we approach global climate change, that we approach it with a sense of personal responsibility and maturity. The Canadian environmentalist and author David Suzuki writes that humanity, us, we're an infant species, newly arrived on the web of life on this world. He says that we are like babies. And I like to imagine that we're the kind of babies who are the terrible two-year-olds or the awful three-nagers. He says that we are brash and exuberant, and we use our incredible inventiveness to blind ourselves from our proper place on the planet. And I would add that this same exuberance has led to a collective amnesia about how we came into this world and how others will find that world once we leave it. But we have the ability to regain our memories with the ancient and underutilized virtue of humility. Humility that allows us to learn to respond to the planet, to love all life, not just our own lives, and to reduce our impact on the earth. Humility that is found in changing our expectations when appropriate, living frugally, and being open to the surprises and insights that come from simplifying our lives. The author Jeffrey Lockwood, a Unitarian Universalist, encourages all of us to remember that we are visitors in this world, guests whose time and influence should be of short duration. And when we realize this, we become more fully human. Lockwood counsels us to remember that we are best when we see ourselves as uninvited, but not unwelcomed, guests of the planet. And our personal response to that reality as guests in this delicate house known as the Earth, besides awe and gratitude, most naturally, is humility. And here's another very useful way of understanding humility. Humility is not so much about shrinking and not taking up space. So we don't have to roll up the carpet of our technology in our advanced society. We don't have to decamp for caves or huts. We don't have to go back to the Stone Age. But we do have to take up the appropriate amount of space. This is something that has been illustrated by the anthropologist and Jewish ethicist Alan Marinus, who recommends that we move humbly in this world that is on loan to us. Our task is not to be without an impact, but to have an appropriate impact, to take up the appropriate amount of space. There's room for human beings in the forest, but there also has to be room for the bobcat and the white-tailed deer and the spotted frog and the oak tree and the bald eagle. We have a rightful place in the grand scheme of things, but so do they. For much of our civilization, we've forgotten about what it means to take up appropriate space. We've become forgetful and instead have taken on the principle that we have a right to subdue the earth, to take dominion over it. And that is a false principle. We know this. That has only led to the destruction of the land, the water, and the air. We know now very clearly that we can't continue down that path. The consequences are already here for us to see them. Our task is to remember our place, to remember our role, that we are called to move in this world with humility and to leave a legacy that a future generation and future generations hence would be glad to inherit. We must expect nothing. We must live frugally, as Alice Walker, the Black eco-feminist activist and poet, reminds us. We cannot afford to feel sorry for ourselves or to feel sorry for the disrepair of the world. We must conform ourselves and our wishes to the Earth's ability to provide, because for far too long we've demanded too much. Humility is the key to our salvation. I don't know if we realize this, in the ecological sense as well as in the spiritual sense. And my vision for us is to be awake and to be aware of the danger that we are in right now, and to recognize the opportunity that this crisis is offering us. My message is not a list of actionable steps that you can take to mitigate climate change, but rather, my vision for us is to accept the invitation to live with purpose, born out of humility, and to remember our obligation to deliver the world into the future for the generations who are waiting to receive it. Seeing as how we have been entrusted with the special gift of a habitable world, we must continually ask ourselves, what kind of state do we want to hand it over in? I see us rising to the occasion. We can do this. And handing over, when the time comes, a world that is more in balance, with more stability, with restored ecosystems. But it will not be easy work. It will require radical and comprehensive changes, more than individuals can do, but individuals should certainly start. These changes promise to be disruptive. They will take us out of our comfort zone, and maybe they will cause us pain. But we have to make up for lost time. We owe it to the future. And lastly, talking about this vision that I have, take this with you. I see future generations of unborn children blessing our names, praising our actions, both big and small, thanking those who came before them, who worked in whatever way they could to be good stewards of this earth. And in their memories, and in their future recollections, I imagine that we might experience something like an afterlife, a happy afterlife, warmed in the eternal sunshine of grateful and contented hearts at peace. We can do this. We can live in that world. We can hand over that world. I will conclude with this. Wendell Berry once described the greatest need for us is to be exceptional. Our culture needs exceptional people, he said. People who remember that we borrow this world from future generations. We are called to be exceptional starting today. The world needs exceptional people. I believe that we are going to survive and that we are going to thrive, and we will do this by embracing our proper place in the web of life, taking up the appropriate amount of space, and remembering, most of all, that this world is not for ourselves alone. Blessed be.